I am Planta on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Tim Ward joins me now. He's on to discuss an old book of his, What the Buddha Never Taught. It's been reissued on the occasion of its 20th anniversary. A new paperback is available from Thomas Allen Publishers. It's a book that was a critical hit and a bestseller when it came out 20 years ago. It's a memoir of Mr. Ward's month or so in a Thai monastery. We'll discuss that, how he ended up there, what he learned, and what it was all about. Tim Ward is the author of five books, including three, including this one, which was on the 6 years he spent living in Asia. He lives in Washington, but joins me from here in Vancouver now, where he spent some time in the 1980s getting a degree from UBC before leaving for the already mentioned 6 years in Asia. His website for more is at timwardsbooks.com. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Tim Ward. Good morning, Mr. Ward.
Good morning, Joe. Happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us. How did this reissue come about? I mean, most books that are 20 years old, do they get republished?
No, I mean, I've actually often joked that, you know, only the Dalai Lama gets this kind of a redo.
Yeah.
On books like this. But it was my good fortune to be approached about a year ago by the publishers of Thomas Allen, which are actually the same team that published the original book 20 years ago when they were part of a now-defunct company called Somerville House. These same people basically said, you know, this book, the only reason it ever went out of print is because our company went bankrupt. Now we've got this new company. It's 20 years later. There's a whole new generation that's really ready to be introduced to this book, and the story's timeless, so we want to do it again. I was frankly really surprised, but it wasn't obviously hard to convince me. And indeed, because the story is based around this monastery, which is following these sort of timeless precepts laid down by the Buddha 2,500 years ago, it really is timeless.
Yeah, I'm reading the book at the moment, and if I didn't know it was 20 years old, I wouldn't have thought, you know, that this happened, what, 25 years ago?
Right,
yeah.
Right.
When the book did come out 20 years ago, I was in, 8 at the time, so I don't remember the success of it, but how successful was it? It was a bestseller, was it?
Yeah, it sold about 50,000 copies altogether. It was published in Canada, in the U.S., in the U.K., and then it got all these crazy foreign translations, too. So it's been published in German, in Spanish, in Greek, and in Chinese. And, in fact, just this week, I think as a result of the tour that I'm doing in British Columbia, I got a request from a Malaysian publisher to put out a Malaysian edition as well. So it's got this great resonance for, you know, a wide range of people, both those who are interested in Buddhism, or what I call the Buddha curious, but also anybody who's interested in what it's really like to be in a completely foreign environment, and what it's like for Westerners to want to practice the spiritual traditions of other peoples.
Now, you mentioned it's been translated into all these different languages.
Yeah.
Do you read those languages? Probably not, right?
No, I don't. I have had some friends of mine who do speak other languages. I give them the copies of the books. For example, a Spanish friend of mine read the Spanish edition. A Chinese friend read the Chinese edition. But I really have no idea how accurately they translate or not.
Yeah. Your book, how is that viewed in Thailand? Probably a lot less well than say, a book by the Dalai Lama, right?
Yes. In fact, one of the interesting things about this book is it ended up getting this really bad reputation amongst foreign monks in Thailand. And there's an interesting story. I went back 10 years after I wrote the book to Thailand, commissioned to do a magazine article on Westerners who'd become Buddhist monks while living in Thailand, and I was sitting around with a group of four monks that I'd met up with at a monastery in Bangkok, and we were talking about their reasons for their conversion, and one of them suddenly said, "Hey, wait a minute, you're Tim Ward, did you write a book?" And I said, "Oh yeah, I wrote What the Buddha Never Taught," and they all jumped up and they said, "Oh, we can't talk to you." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" They said, "Oh, you wrote that book, which, you know, was like an expose of monastic life." And I said, no, if you read the book, you know that's not it at all. And they said, "Oh, we would never read a book like that."
Yeah.
But so they all left, but then they came back to me one at a time, and they said, "You know, really, don't tell anybody, but we think it's good to write a book that's critical of the Buddhist community. They need to hear this stuff." getting these really interesting mixed messages. At the one hand, I'd really hit a nerve because, you know, I wasn't writing a book intending to be critical. I was writing just my own story of what I experienced, what happened to me while I was in this monastery. But some of that included really reporting accurately on evidence of hypocrisy within the hierarchy, people sort of using the rules or bending them to for their what seemed like personal ends. I just wrote about what happened, but you don't say anything critical of the Buddhist hierarchy in Thailand. That's like very, very bad form, and I sort of broke that taboo, which, you know, on the one hand made it a bad book, but on the other hand made it a good book. So I've enjoyed that notoriety.
Yeah. So let's go back 25 years or so. You're in Vancouver.
Yeah.
You just finished at UBC. What compelled you to go to Asia? And did you know that you were going to spend 6 years there?
No, I didn't. I had my degree in Western philosophy. And when I graduated, you know, I sort of stood on the shores of the wrecked beach out by UBC and looked west and realized, man, I know nothing about the philosophy of most of the world on the other side of this ocean. So I really wanted to go and find out for myself. So I worked for a while, got a one-way ticket to New Delhi, thinking that I would go for a year. I saved up enough money for 1 year. But it turned out that I was able to live so cheaply that I was able to travel for 2 years on $4,000.
Yeah.
In Asia. And then I got a job teaching English in China, and I stayed for another year. And then I moved for Japan and to Japan and started working as a journalist. And I just really enjoy living in Asia. I enjoy the differences of Asia, and I enjoy the depth of their sort of philosophical systems.
And your religious background was what?
Yeah, I was an evangelical Christian when I left.
Yeah.
And I can only say that Buddhist monasteries and Hindu ashrams beat out of me any idea that Christianity was somehow a superior religion.
And in this journey, you mentioned a superior religion. Do you think that the either Hindu or Buddhism is superior, or do you not think in that way?
I really don't think in that way at all anymore. These days I tend to think that all religions are human-made systems that attempt to explore and sometimes capture the essence of experiences that connect us with all of life in a way that's profound and really essential. But it's that experience that's essential rather than the religious forms and structures around it. Some religious forms and structures really encourage and enable individuals to make these profound connections. And Buddhism at its best does this. But so does Christianity at its best, and Islam at its best. What I love about Buddhism is it's easiest to separate out the myth from the practice, which can bring you to these blinding moments of illumination. And indeed, there's lots of people in North America these days who consider themselves secular Buddhists. One group that's in Victoria have as their motto, no robes, no ritual, no religion. They just want the practice. They just want, they just really want the baby. They don't want any of the bath water at all.
So what do you, what does one learn or get out of Buddhism that you possibly can't get out of other religions?
Yeah, I think that the first thing is Buddhism is a science of mind, and what it teaches us is that when we sit and we look at our own mind, we see our minds are chronically dissatisfied and anxious. And they tend to search for something to scratch that itch of dissatisfaction. And what we tend to do is we tend to try to satisfy that through consumer goods, through entertainment, through distraction, whether it's iPhones or a sort of business model that keeps us wired to our computers all day long. Gosh, I struggle with that every day. So we keep our minds intensely engaged in things to make us feel okay. But if we're quiet, if we try to still our minds, then we can see just how anxious we really are. And what Buddhism does is it tries to deal with that fundamental anxiousness and take you to a place where you can really have deep, sustained, calm acceptance of the world exactly as it is and yourself exactly as you are. And then you can sort of relax into loving yourself and the world, And the Buddha gives you, Buddhism gives you all sorts of meditation techniques and ways of looking at things that can help you get there. You don't actually need a belief in God or divinity or morality or anything to do this. You just put these principles into practice and see what happens.
Is that what you were looking for when you went on this journey?
Yes, it was. That plus an understanding of how the people of Asia incorporate their various religious beliefs into everyday life. And I think that, especially in the 21st century, as China and India are really emerging as dominant new superpowers, it behooves us all to better understand what are the forces that shape their way of seeing, thinking, and knowing. We really don't get it, what's going on in Asia. And I think that better understanding Buddhism and Hinduism and Confucianism is really a useful survival skill for North Americans.
You mentioned the idea of getting away from our material objects as something that Buddhism teaches us. Mm-hmm. You mentioned you struggle with technology yourself, cell phones, computers, and the sort. Do you think that going there has made this struggle easier? Do you find that, coming back to North America, you probably weren't as practicing a Buddhist as say the people in the monastery were.
Right.
Do you find it easier though to say unplug the computer at times or turn off the cell phone?
Yeah, what I find and what the Buddhist practice really gave me is that more often during the day, I'm able to literally recall my being. Does that make sense? I'm able to sort of stop and say, wait a sec, take a deep breath, and remember what it is to be a human being in a body, given this precious life to live in this beautiful world we have. And I say this sitting in my hotel in downtown Vancouver, looking out across at North Van with the snow dusting the treetops in the mountains across the way, and it's just beautiful. And being alive is joyful. And when we get caught up in these distractions, we can lose this joy of being alive in this present moment. And that joy is really the foundation of spiritual practice. So for me, the monastery brings me back to those moments more often than I would if I hadn't had that experience. And I know sometimes when I'm feeling stressed, I can just relax, take a deep breath, and, you know, I've reset myself. And I think for me that's more valuable than spending your whole life in a monastery where you're just, you know, sitting meditating all the time. Sure, maybe you're on the path to enlightenment, but I love being in the world where I'm interacting with friends, people, business, colleagues, and associates, and every interaction is an opportunity to pass on a little bit of that joy and reality in life. If I can recall my human beingness, then someone else engaged with me can recall their human beingness. And that really is what life's all about. There's a lovely quote from the Buddha which I'd love to pass on, and that is, the Buddha said at one point, the beginning, the end of Buddhism is spiritual friendship. And being able to connect with somebody, that's, you know, the way you pass your practice on.
What did you learn about women after being in a monastery?
Well, I can only say I went into the monastery really being deeply troubled with women in my life and wondering, do I choose a path of throwing myself into sexual relationships or do I choose a path of renunciation pursuing the spiritual ideal? And I'm really fortunate that I've been able to combine the two in life and see that it's not an either-or thing. I have had so many women problems in my life, and they were only really resolved by finding a woman I was able to truly love and commit my heart to, and I've been with her quite happily for 15 years, and that's been a huge blessing, really beyond anything I got in the monastery. But learning to actually see another person in a woman rather than merely be sexually infatuated or projecting, you know, what you never got from your mom on a woman, those sorts of things that take a lot of trial and error for each of us to work out. So I think relationships are a huge and thorny issue. And Buddhist practice really doesn't teach you to do this. Buddhist practice teaches you relationships are suffering. So just throwing yourself into relationships is not necessarily a way to get enlightened, and throwing yourself into Buddhist practice is not necessarily a way to have good relationships.
And that happened to you. You after you came back, you're involved in marriage, and this is all in the back of the book.
Yes, that's right.
There's a new, I don't know what you call that, a new...
Afterward, I guess.
Yeah. About what happened to you when you came back and the first marriage that you were in.
Oh, yeah, and I certainly ended up experiencing suffering in that first marriage,
And was it because of the monastery experience? Do you think that contributed to it?
That's a piece of it. It really made me see dissatisfaction and suffering as something that, you know, I should just expect in life, but that left me with so much of it in my relationship that the relationship was not actually nurturing me. And the truth of the matter is, if you're going to spend your life with somebody, it should be because you're able to nurture each other and because being together is a pleasant experience. And, I think I misapplied some Buddhist teachings there. Sometimes you need to act on dissatisfaction. That's how you get change and how you get growth. So people who get too Buddhist about relationships tend to accept too much suffering. And it's not always the right path. And in my case, I ended up blowing things up spectacularly by having, affairs when I was still married for the first time, and then that blew up. I ended up with a divorce and ended up, raising my son half-time as a divorced dad. And I thought relationships were really just an awful, messy thing until I met this lovely, lovely woman and really sort of got what love and relationship can be.
Did you advise that young people should engage in the sort of self-discovery and introspection that you went, this path that you went on?
You know, not necessarily the specific path, but I think it's absolutely essential, Joe, for every young person, every teen who's struggling with this, every person, in their early 20s, to really find their own meaning in life. And what distresses me is when I hear young people say, what I really want to do is make money. Or they look to a career because of its status or its financial rewards. And they're taking other people's values and making them their own, rather than doing the tough searching work for finding where's the meaning in their own bones. But that meaning is going to be very different for some people. Some people are going to, find that meaning in music. Others may find it in being bond traders. They might really, get a thrill out of that. But to find it through your own authentic search and struggle, I think that's what young people mean. And I don't see that as being an ethic for young people that they're committed to. That's kind of easy just to go for what looks like it's going to make you successful by other people's standards. Don't like that. Blah. Tear up other people's standards. Find your own standards. That's sort of my message. And I think this book has that message for young people, that you want to go and search. You want to struggle with the meaninglessness of life that Buddhism points to. It points out that, the things you think are full of meaning, they're not. They're hollow. They're shells. They'll shatter. Don't build your life on something that's going to shatter.
I mentioned off the top, this is the 20th anniversary of the book. It's a book that if you look it up online, a lot of people have talked about. What did the young people say in your life? What did they get out of it, do you think? And not just the young people, say just relatives, friends, and the sort.
Sure. Well, let me start first with young people. One of the lovely things about this book is it's been picked up by several universities to be a text in their Buddhism 101 class. University of Toronto, really the best one. For the past decade or so, it's been the book that the teachers of this course have started with, the sort of their first introduction to Buddhism. And I often go to these classes just to meet with the students. And I have a great time listening to them and seeing how this book fits into their own struggles to make spiritual sense of the world, a world which isn't necessarily got the answers given to them, and they're questing for it. Frankly, if you're taking Buddhism 101, you're going to be questing for things. kids wrestling with their own experiences and with my experiences as a young man in a monastery, wrestling with, you know, where do you find meaning in life? So I love that. In my own life, I've got a son who's now 20 years old. He was actually born the year What the Buddha Never Taught came out. And he and I have long conversations about what makes life meaningful. In fact, Joe, my next book is about my son and I doing a trek up Mount Kilimanjaro together that we did this past summer. And that includes our conversations on what makes life meaningful. How do you forge and find your own meaning? And I love seeing my son go through his own struggles and finding the things that he's passionate about in life. It's a beautiful thing to, you know, see not just him but those who are his friends taking the struggle on.
And you mentioned that you'd gone back 10 years after you'd left the monastery.
Yes.
To do other work. Had it changed a great deal?
I did go to the monastery itself. I went back to Thailand and talked to other foreign monks. But the monastery has grown almost exponentially in terms of its in terms of setting up branch monasteries around the world. There are now 62 branch monasteries from this initial monastery that I was at 25 years ago, including three in Canada. There's two in Ontario, and there's one in Knutsford, British Columbia. I had an event last night at the University of British Columbia, and some lay people who are part supporters of this Knutsford community showed up. They read the book. They've even read some of the criticism of this book that's been out there from the monastery. But they had a very open attitude towards this, and they thought that it's great to be writing about this sort of thing. So the work of this branch of Buddhism is really spreading, and some people are finding it really vital and beautiful for their lives. I'm so happy about that. You know, Buddhism originated in Nepal and India, and it spread through all of Southeast Asia, right through to China and Japan. But as it entered each culture, it changed to fit the culture that it went into. Buddhism has really only entered the West in the last 50 years. We may be just at the beginning of a 300 or 400-year-old process, which is going to radically transform how Westerners see themselves by being able to integrate the beauties of what the Buddha taught. So that's exciting to me.
Yeah, and do you think that Buddhism has changed coming to North America, say, whether it's in Knutsford or in Hollywood even?
I think it's really just at the beginning of this change, and you see some excesses along the way. Some Buddhist teachers have really crashed and burned spectacularly in North America, and others have built quite dramatic followings. I think that the Dalai Lama and many Tibetan Buddhists have really changed the hearts and minds of so many people towards this compassionate Buddhist path. The more somber, more meditation-focused work of the monastic lineage from What the Buddha Never Taught, that's also here too, with a strong appeal to those who want to be this more focused individualistic approach. So yeah, I think that there's all these strands of Buddhism that are all coming into North America, and for the first time, it's being integrated into a mindset which is rather scientific, which questions myth, which questions monastic authority, doesn't particularly like it, but is really willing to tease out, you know, what's really useful, which is what the Buddha always said, take what's useful and use it, and don't get hung up on what's not useful. So Buddhism in North America, I believe, is going to become a unique and powerful force over the next few hundred years. And hey, frankly, we need it, because our current path of consumption and heedless environmental destruction, those old values of the Industrial Revolution, they're going to destroy the planet. But the Buddhist values of being satisfied with your human life as it is and treasuring all living things as beings of life worthy of preserving and respecting, you know, that's really the path to salvation for humanity.
When does the Kilimanjaro book come out?
It should be out in 2012. That's my hope. And it's got a great title I'd love to share with your listeners.
Yeah.
zombies on Kilimanjaro.
I mean, it's just, the way you described it earlier, it just sounds like, you know, I can't wait to read it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I'll work hard on getting it finished for you.
I'm enjoying this book, going back to this book and reading it, and I've enjoyed our conversation today, Tim.
Thank you so much, Joe. I've enjoyed speaking with you.
Thanks. The website for more is timwardsbooks.com. The book is called What the Buddha Never Taught. The 20th anniversary edition is from Thomas Allen Publishers. Its author, Tim Ward, on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.